Chapter 7. Cabrillo crossed himself. The victims were of all ages, though they were predominantly in their 20s, from what he could tell. Some had been dead for quite some time. Their bodies were black with lividity, and several were bloated with internal gas. Others had apparently drowned when the pirates dumped the container over the side of the fishing boat. They appeared sickly pale under the deck lights. It was hard to tell in the jumble of limbs, but it looked as though there were more men than women. The one thing they all had in common, other than their gruesome deaths, was that every one of them was Chinese. Snakeheads, Cabrillo spat with disgust, looking out to where an oil slick still burned on the dark ocean. Eager to seek work outside China, peasants and even moderately well-to-do workers paid upwards of $30,000 to be smuggled out of the country. Of course, even a wealthy Chinese couldn't come up with that kind of cash, so a system was put in place whereby the illegal immigrant would work for the gangs who smuggled them, paying off the debt by toiling in sweatshops or restaurants in every city from New York to New Delhi. The women were generally prostituted in massage parlors that sprang up even in small towns across America and Canada. They labored for years, living in overcrowded apartments owned by the gangs until the entire debt was repaid. If they tried to run away, their families back in China would be tortured or killed. In this way, more than a million Chinese a year left one bitter, dead-end existence for another, all believing the promise that things would improve if only they worked harder. The immigrants had a name for their journey to a new life. It was called riding the snake, and those who ran the gangs were called snakeheads. Cabrillo and his crew had intercepted a shipload of illegals most likely on their way to Japan, or the pirates had hijacked such a boat and were planning on selling the laborers back to the gang or to some third party. Either way, they had stumbled onto a human trafficking ring. Past his horror at what lay on the deck of his ship, beyond the grief that built behind his eyes, Juan Cabrillo felt a spark of anger flare in his chest. He nurtured it, fanning it with hate until it roared and threatened to consume him. He turned to Linda Ross, his eyes glacial hard. "Get Dr. Huxley up here as soon as she's able. There's nothing she can do for these poor people, but autopsies might shed some light on what happened." He motioned to the deckhands. "As soon as orderlies empty the container, check it for any kind of ID numbers, then heave it over the side." "Are you okay, Juan?" Linda asked with concern. "No. I'm pissed," he said as he strode away. "And I still have a submarine to deal with." He took his seat in the operation center. Word had already spread, and the mood was subdued. Mark Murphy was running systems checks on the shipboard weapons in case they were needed again, while Eric Stone sat quietly at the helm station awaiting orders. "Mr. Murphy," Cabrillo called sharply. Mark turned in his seat, a grave look on his face. It had been his shot that blew up the craw and ruined any chance of interrogating prisoners.
"Yes, sir."
The chairman's voice softened.
"Don't blame yourself. I would have plugged her in the same place. We're in this for the long haul. There'll be others."
"Yes, sir. Thank you."
"Mr. Stone, make your speed 30 knots and put us over that submarine."
"Aye, sir."
Linda was still on deck, doubtlessly helping Julia and her medical team. Juan monitored the passive sonar array and called course and speed corrections to Stone until they had the Oregon directly over the mysterious sub. It had settled to 75 feet in the half hour since they'd first detected it. He washed the acoustical signal through the computer, filtering out extraneous sounds until all he heard was the slow escape of air from the craft. He couldn't tell if the sub was just playing dead or if it was having a problem. But if there were some sort of emergency, surely he'd hear alarm klaxons and crewmen working within the pressure hull. Even without the sophisticated listening devices, the sound of metal banging on metal would carry right through to the Oregon. Yet all that came through was the burbling hiss of the slowly sinking sub. Juan pulled up a chart of the region on the computer. There were nearly 2 miles of water under the keel. It would be days before the sub hit bottom, although by then she would have long since collapsed after passing her crush depth. He went back to his own seat and called down to the moon pool.
Dive master, this is Cabrillo. Open the hull doors and prepare an ROV for a shallow water recon. Also have 2 divers standing by and lay out some gear for me.
15 minutes later, Cabrillo stood behind the ROV's pilot wearing an orange wetsuit. His goggles were strapped around his left arm. There was no need for him to dive on the sub, but for his own desire to feel the freshening calm of the ocean's embrace. His shoulders and neck ached from tension and rage. The underwater probe was a small torpedo-shaped craft with 3 variable-pitch propellers along its axis for propulsion and maneuverability. In its domed nose was a high-resolution video camera, and mounted on its back were enough lights to illuminate a 10-foot swath in even the murkiest water. The craft had just been launched, and 2 workers made sure its unspooling tether ran free from the ship. The huge doors that were opened to the sea allowed a chill to creep into the cavernous amidships hold, while underwater lights attached to the hull cast a wavering green reflection along the bulkheads. The big Nomad 1000 submersible loomed over the pool like an airship, ready just in case they needed her powerful manipulator arm.
Passing 50 feet, the operator announced, his attention fixed on the screen showing a live feed from the ROV's camera. All it revealed was blackness.
His fingers rested on a pair of joysticks that controlled the probe.
60 feet.
There,
Cabrillo pointed. From out of the gloom came the faintest trace of an outline. It was murky and indistinct at first, but resolved itself as the ROV approached. The probe had come upon the sub from the stern. It was her bronze propeller that glinted in the powerful lights. Then they could discern her rudder. It looked like no sub Juan had ever seen.
Bring us up 5 feet and forward another 10.
The operator followed his orders and the prop slid under the camera's view. They could see steel hull plates, but these weren't in the cigar shape of a typical submarine. Linda had said the craft was odd when she'd hit it with active sonar to check its shape. Suddenly, they could see the word HAM painted in white against the black hull.
Back us off, Cabrillo said.
The little undersea robot eased in reverse and the word expanded into gibberish. U-T-H-A-M-P-T-O. What the hell is an uthampto? One of the divers asked.
Not what, Juan replied. Where?
Southampton, England. And as he spoke, the full name of the vessel's home port came into view as well as her name, Avalon. And she wasn't a sub at all.
Do you think this is the ship where the pirates pulled the refugees?
I doubt it.
Cabrillo stared at the screen as the probe sailed over the ship's stern rail and across her aft deck. A few fish swam amid the tangle of gear.
But I'm sure she was one of their victims.
I bet she was attacked just before we got into radar range.
He called up to the bridge to have Mark Murphy run a check on the British-flagged ship.
Wouldn't we have heard an SOS? The diver asked.
Not if the pirates jammed them or boarded using some trick that allowed them to take out our radios before a warning could be sent.
Chairman, it's Murph. The Avalon belongs to the Royal Geographic Society. Launched in 1982, she's 130 feet long, displaces...
Cabrillo cut him off.
When was she last heard from?
According to a press release from the RGS, all contact was lost with her 4 days ago. American search and rescue units out of Okinawa didn't find a thing.
That doesn't make any sense, Juan said for his benefit and not for those around him.
He puzzled aloud.
If she was boarded and the pirates cut communications, the SAR crews should have spotted her in no time.
Not if they sank her right away, the ROV pilot answered.
There's no way she would have sunk only 75 feet in 4 days.
Cabrillo paused.
Unless. unless someone managed to stop her from taking on more water.
She'd still keep sinking, the diver said. If she'd lost enough buoyancy to sink this far, she'd have lost enough to keep going down.
Cabrillo regarded the man.
Good point. Unless she became trapped in a halocline, a band of highly saline water. Salt water is more dense than fresh, so an equal volume displaces more weight. The ocean is layered like a cake with striations of water with differing salt levels and temperatures. It's possible the Avalon sank into a layer of super-dense water that's maintaining her equilibrium for the time being.
He was aware that the ship was still taking on water, so eventually she would slip through the band of water, then plunge like a stone. The men watched in silence as the probe glided over the sunken vessel. There were no outward signs of a struggle, no bullet holes or evidence of explosion. It was as though she'd just slid beneath the waves without a fight. Once the probe reached the Avalon's bow, Cabrillo had the pilots swing her along the superstructure and see if they could peer into any of the windows.
"Do you think anyone's still alive on her?" the diver suddenly blurted.
Juan had already considered and discarded the idea. He'd seen firsthand how savage the pirates were and knew they wouldn't have left behind any witnesses, even on a scuttled ship. Further proof was the derelict's silence. If he'd been trapped on a sunken vessel, he would have done something to attract attention, no matter how futile. He would have banged on the hull with a wrench until he could no longer move his arms. Then he would have shouted until his dying breath. No. He was certain no one was left alive aboard the Avalon. The ROV swept back across the Avalon's deck, heading for the bridge. In the tight cone of light, they could see the big windows had all been smashed, either by the pirates or when the research vessel slipped into the sea. The pilot eased the probe through one of the empty window frames, mindful that the armored tether could easily tangle. The ceiling looked like a shimmering wall of liquid mercury. It was an air pocket, fed by a string of bubbles leaking up from a small hole in the floor. There was ample evidence of the attack on the bridge. Stitched lines of bullet holes crisscrossed the room, and brass shells littered the deck. A pile of what looked to be rags or a tarp in one corner revealed itself to be a body. Tiny fish darted at the tendrils of blood still leaking from the numerous wounds. The pilot tried to maneuver so they could see the dead man's face and maybe make an ID, but the little probe didn't have the power to roll what had once been a large man.
"See if you can find a way to access the rest of the superstructure," Cabrillo ordered.
The pilot tried, but they found the door at the rear of the bridge jammed with a metal bar across the latches.
"Never mind. Back us out and check the portholes. Maybe we can see inside her."
The probe ran first down the Avalon's port side, pausing at each porthole, but they couldn't see anything within the hull. Inside was Stygian black. The operator swung around her stern and started up the starboard. The light cast a perfect circle along the black hull, and each round window glittered like a jewel. The instant it shone into one of the cabins, there came the sharp sound of metal banging against metal. It was a frantic, staccato tattoo. The men monitoring the screen recoiled as a pale face suddenly appeared at the window. It was a woman. Her eyes were huge with fear, and her mouth moved as she shouted a scream they could not hear.
"Dear God! She's alive!"
Cabrillo had already moved to a bench seat and was snugging the straps of his twin air tanks over his shoulders. Next came the buoyancy compensator that looped around his neck. He struggled to his feet to cinch a weight belt around his waist. The two other divers were quickly following suit. He snatched up a pair of swim fins and a powerful flashlight. "Alert Huxley," he said as he waddled to the moon pool, burdened by 60 pounds of gear. He adjusted his mask, checked his airflow, and fell back into the water. As he dropped through a curtain of bubbles, Cabrillo slid his feet into the fins, then purged some water that had seeped in around his mask. The water wasn't that cold, and his body heat quickly warmed the thin layer trapped inside his wetsuit.
He waited just long enough for the two other divers to hit the water before dumping air from his BC and dropping into the darkness, one hand on the probe's tether as a guide. How had she survived, he wondered. Judging by the damage fish had done to the corpse on the bridge, the pirates had scuttled the Avalon shortly after taking her. Was there that much air trapped inside her hull? Obviously, the answer was yes. The question was if it would last until they could get her out. Below him, he saw the corona of light from the probe and shadowy details of the research ship. Air spilled from at least a dozen spots around her hull, as though she were bleeding. Juan felt a superstitious chill down his spine. The Avalon had become a ghost ship, but unlike the Flying Dutchman, she'd been cursed to sail through the darkness below the seas, a forlorn wanderer on borrowed time. When he reached the main deck, Juan checked the depth gauge on his dive computer. He was down to 83 feet. The Avalon was sinking faster. Her borrowed time was running out. He finned down to where the ROV hovered motionless outside the porthole where they'd spied the survivor. When he peered in through the small, round window, the trapped woman jumped back in fright. She quickly came forward again so an inch of water and a thick pane of glass separated their faces. If Juan didn't come up with something quick, the gulf would remain insurmountable. She wore two jackets and several sweaters. Her hair was covered in a wool watchman's cap. The air inside the ship would be the same temperature as the water. A quick check told him 51 degrees. Her eyes were bright blue, and now that he'd arrived, they had lost their edge of madness. As desperate as she was, she still retained some semblance of humor because she tapped her watch as if to say, "About time." Juan admired her courage. Then he took in the subtle details and noticed her lips were blue and her face an unnatural white. Her body quivered with uncontrollable paroxysms. He looked deeper into the cabin. Water completely covered the small room up to the level of the bed frames. One mattress floated free while the woman kept the other anchored with her weight. Yet even her refuge hadn't remained dry, and neither had her clothes. With her kneeling on the mattress, her weight formed a depression that pooled with seawater. No doubt her feet were soaked as well. Unable to know how long she'd been in this condition, he was certain she'd be hypothermic soon. Juan removed his regulator and mouthed, "Are you all right?" The seawater against his lips was bitterly salty, confirming his earlier supposition about how the Avalon had delayed her plunge to the bottom. She gave him a flat stare as if to say he was nuts to ask, given the circumstances, then nodded to tell him she wasn't injured. He pointed at her and held up a finger, then pointed to other places on the ship, holding up more fingers. It took her a moment to realize he was asking if there were others with her. She shook her head sadly. Then she held up a finger and disappeared for a moment. When she returned, she had a pad of paper and a black marker. Her hand shook so much her writing was barely legible. "I'm the only one. Can you get me out?" Juan nodded that he could, although he had no idea how. They could attach lines from the Oregon's cranes to the research vessel and try to haul her to the surface, only the cranes had nowhere near the power to deadlift a sinking ship, and if they got the balance wrong, she could tilt and fill even faster than she was now. However, it would be worth getting some lines down to the Avalon so they could at least stabilize her for the time being. The other divers reached Juan. He wrote out instructions on a slate one of them carried and sent the man back to the Oregon. He turned back to the trapped woman and winked. She wrote something on her pad and held it to the glass. "Who are you?" He wrote out his name. She flashed him a look of frustration and wrote, "Are you with the Navy?" Uh-oh. How could he explain their presence? He wrote back that he headed a private security company hired to bring the pirates to justice. She seemed satisfied. He asked her to describe where water hadn't yet flooded the Avalon. She wrote that the bridge deck was flooded and the bilge and engine room. Water had been climbing her deck for the past 12 hours. He asked if there were any exterior doors that he could open that would only flood a small room,
an antechamber of some sort that could be isolated from the rest of the ship. She wrote that she wasn't sure, then fell back onto the bed. Water welled up through the mattress around her backside and shoulders. The woman didn't seem to notice or no longer had the strength to do anything about it. Juan pounded the butt of his dive light against the hull to rouse her. She opened her eyes but barely registered his presence. She was slipping away. He pounded his light again and the woman crawled to the porthole once more. Her eyes were glassy and her jaw chattered like she was holding the business end of a jackhammer. He couldn't get her out without her help, and she was maybe 5 minutes away from unconsciousness. "What is your name?" he wrote. She stared at the words for a moment, then mouthed something Juan couldn't understand. He shook his riding slab to remind her how they were communicating. It took her 20 seconds of intense concentration to write, "Tori. Tori, you must stay awake. You sleep, you die. Is there a small room you can seal that has an exterior door?" He was afraid she was too far gone to understand the question, but her shoulders suddenly straightened, and she managed to clamp her jaw tight. She nodded and began to write. It took 4 minutes by Cabrillo's stainless Concord chronograph because she had to erase many of the words and start over. She finally held her notebook to the porthole. The letters looked like a child's first attempt. She had written, "Tini at Port Dune 1 Deck Op Opons to Estoinwul Thought Can Be Seelical." It took Juan another precious minute to decipher the illegible scrawl. "The aft port door 1 deck up opens to a stairwell that can be sealed. You must go there and seal yourself in. Do not leave no matter what. Trust me." Tori nodded and heaved herself off the bed. As she stood in the knee-deep water, agony etched itself across her features. Juan could almost feel the icy fingers of cold cramping her muscles and sending jolts to her brain. She lurched across the room, lost her balance, nearly caught herself against a bulkhead, then fell heavily. If he could have squeezed through the porthole, Juan would have done so and gathered her up in his arms. As it was, he hung helplessly in the water as Tori slowly dragged herself to her feet. She was drenched. She staggered to the door without a backward glance, moving stiff-limbed like a zombie in a horror movie. As soon as she was out of sight, Juan swam up to find the door she'd described. As he cleared the rail, he saw 4 other divers working to attach a cable sling to the Avalon's stern bollards. They had set up big underwater lights and worked efficiently in their glare. He imagined a team doing the same for. The ship had now settled to 100 feet. Even if the cranes couldn't lift the research vessel, having her secured to the Oregon would prevent her from sinking any deeper for a while. But depth wasn't the problem. Tori's endurance was. Unbeknownst to Cabrillo and his crew, the Avalon had large holds both fore and aft that stretched from her bilge to her main deck and almost the entire breadth of the ship. So far, they had remained dry, thanks to tightly dogged hatches and servo-controlled louvers on the ventilation system that sealed it nearly airtight. It was their buoyancy that aided in keeping the survey ship from free-falling into the depths. While Juan was scrutinizing the door, one of the tightly closed vents began to buckle under the increasing pressure of water that was bottled within the ventilation ducts behind it. A flat jet of water sprayed from a gap between 2 of the louvers. It fell in a fine mist almost all the way across the hold. The slit between the louver's metal fins was tiny, and only a few gallons per minute entered the hold. But every second saw the gap widening, and it was only a matter of time before the louver failed entirely, and a 3-foot-square column of water roared into the hold. The door, Juan noted, was a solid slab, hinged from the outside. He could turn the handle freely once he'd removed a steel clamp that had been locked to prevent anyone from escaping during the initial raid. Only the pressure of the surrounding water kept him from drawing it open. To do that, he needed to equalize the pressure on both sides.
And to do that, he had to flood the antechamber on the other side with Tori trapped inside. It was a straightforward concept, and while Tori was in for the fright of her life as the room filled with water, Juan would have her out and breathing off a spare scuba tank before she was in any real danger. He motioned over one of his divers and wrote what he needed on his slab. This man wore a full helmet with an integrated communication system that allowed him to talk with the dive master aboard the Oregon. Juan tapped the beat of shave and a haircut on the door while he waited for both Tori and his delivery from the ship. Waiting for either was interminable, but when the basket of tools and dive equipment was lowered from above and Tori still hadn't arrived, Juan began to fear the worst. Being trapped anywhere with the bodies of her friends littering the hallways was bad enough. Adding to the psychological stress was the fact that her prison was 100 feet underwater and continuing to sink. It was amazing Tori hadn't gone catatonic days ago. She was frightened, near hypothermic, and now soaking wet. Did she have it in her to reach the antechamber and remember to seal the room from the rest of the ship? Cabrillo had his doubts. But there was no other way. Her cabin door would have burst and flooded the ship had they cut their way into the room. She would have drowned long before they could have made a hole big enough to even pass her a regulator. No, he thought. This was the only plan that could work. He tapped his rhythm against the steel with his light again and again. Then he thought he heard something from within the ship. He tapped again, shave and a haircut, pulled off his hood, and pressed his ear against the door. There, the unmistakable reply. Tap, tap, 2 bits. She'd made it. He reached into the basket of tools he'd requested from the Oregon. First, he checked that the spare scuba tanks were ready. Next came the drill, which fed off 2 compressed air cylinders slung under the wire mesh cage and attached by a long hose. The tip was specially hardened and at the RPMs generated by the air tanks would cut through the door in seconds. Cabrillo looked around. The divers at the stern must have finished securing the cable sling to the Avalon. A pair of them went to help those working at the bow while another 2 came over to help him. Cabrillo braced his back against the heavy basket, pressed the drill bit near the bottom of the door, and pulled the trigger. The piercing whine was like actually standing on a tooth while a dentist went after a particularly nasty cavity. It drove spikes through his ears that met in the middle of a blinding point of pain. He ignored it and watched silver slivers of metal curl away from the drill point. In just a few seconds, the tip bored through and Juan carefully removed the drill from the hole. Water and bits of the shavings were sucked into the ship. He didn't know the size of the antechamber and couldn't guess how long it would take to fill, so all he could do was wait until the pressure had equalized enough for him to open the door. He used a metal pry bar to tap at Tori and tell her he was with her. Her reply came instantly and angrily. She hadn't expected that this was how she'd be rescued. After 4 minutes, Juan pulled at the door with the pry bar, but it remained sealed tight, so he drilled 2 more holes and tried again every minute afterward with the same result. He was about to drill a few more to hurry the operation when something happened. A sudden gush of bubbles exploded from someplace ahead of the superstructure. The louver in the forehold had given way, and thousands of gallons a minute poured into the derelict. The quick rise in pressure had popped an inspection hatch on the main cargo hatch. The 6 divers working at the bow appeared from over the Avalon's squat funnel, fighting their way through the maelstrom of bubbles and surging water. One of them made a cutting gesture across his throat as soon as he was within the circle of light cast by the undersea lamps. They hadn't completed securing the forward sling. In moments, the Avalon began to drop by the head. And then she started to roll to port. The divers had managed to secure only the starboard side of the sling. The Avalon was held to the Oregon by 3 cables, 2 aft and 1 forward. For a few moments, the ship appeared to stabilize, but her off-kilter angle allowed water to enter from other places. The crane operators on the Oregon, no doubt supervised by Max, gamely tried to hold the ship steady for as long as they could, but it was a losing battle. Cabrillo had floated free from the deck in those first frantic seconds, but quickly dropped back to the door. The basket of tools had slid all the way to the scupper. He motioned for one of his men to retrieve it while he hauled on the unyielding hatch. Tori would have been tossed around inside the antechamber when the ship torqued over, and her new angle meant she'd have to tread water until he could get the door open. It was a race against the clock, and time had just accelerated. The cable sling at the bow was looped to one of the ship's mushroom-shaped cast steel bollards. The free end was caught in a jet of air bubbles and danced around the rigging holding the Avalon's forward mast. Because of the uneven load, the cable pulled at the top of the bollard and started to slip off. The steel strands rasped as they were drawn over the top of the bollard, a pitiable cry like a mountain climber at the moment his grip slips from a rock face. With water gushing into the forward hold, the cable remained taut for a few seconds more before sliding off the bollard. The Avalon's bow plummeted, tilting the ship through 90 degrees until she dangled nose down from the straining crane aboard the Oregon, her knife-edged prow pointing into the abyss. Rated for 60 tons, the crane was probably fighting to hold three times that weight, and every second increased the strain. Because of water resistance, the 90-degree rotation had taken a few seconds, long enough for Juan to clutch the door as the deck became a wall and the aft bulkhead became the floor. Then there came a scraping sound, one that tore through the water and seemed to come from every direction. Juan frantically looked around for the source. The light towers his crew had erected were still tumbling across the deck, creating a nightmare effect of glare and blackness. The sound grew louder. Juan glanced up to see a lifeboat that pulled free from its davits, hurtling down the length of the ship. He dove to the side as it raced past, its momentum pulling at him like a whirlpool. The davit cables trailing the lifeboat were a thick tangle of inch-thick rope that caught him just as he looked back to see if his people avoided the speeding projectile. The knot of rope slammed into the back of his head, tearing off his face mask. He fought the pain and disorientation, groping for the mask as it swirled in the back eddies. He opened his eyes, the sting of salt worse than any he'd ever felt. But there, just beyond his fingers, the orange mask was slipping into the depths. He grabbed it, snapped it back over his face, purging it by tilting his head and allowing air from his regulator to expel the water. He swam back to the door, checking his wrist computer. The Avalon was sinking at 10 feet a minute and accelerating. He knew Max would run out every foot of cable on the Oregon to slow her descent, but there were limits to how deep they could breathe off compressed air. The other diver had been thrown violently when the ship upended. It took him a few moments to clear his head and find the tool chest where it had lodged against the rail near the ship's jackstaff. He didn't bother with the drill and instead concentrated on taking the spare air tank and a dive bag up to the chairman. Together they heaved against the door with the pry bar. A curtain of bubbles exploded around the seam for a second. They'd managed to open it a crack, but pressure slammed it closed again. They pulled harder. Juan felt as though the muscles of his back were being stripped from his bones, and black stars exploded behind his tightly closed eyes. Just as he was about to stop and shift to a new position, the door swung open, instantly flooding the last of the interior space. The powerful lights they'd set on the aft deck had either smashed themselves to pieces or were lost over the fantail, so all he had was his trusty dive light. He swung the beam around the antechamber. The space was cramped, painted a drab white. A set of metal stairs dropped to a solid-looking hatch that had once led to the bridge deck. Another door to the right that gave access to the interior of the main deck had also been secured. Then he saw Tori, a dark, drifting shape of sodden clothes and loose limbs. Her hair fanned around her head like an anemone on a tropical reef. In two swift kicks, Juan was at her side. He slid his regulator past her slack lips and upped the airflow, trying to force the precious gas into her lungs. The other diver joined him and ripped open his dive bag. As fast as he could work, he plucked fistfuls of chemical warming packs from the bag, shook them violently to start the reaction, and stuffed them under Tori's clothes. They had several decompression stops to make on their ascent, and this was the only way Juan could think of to protect her from the biting cold. He took back his regulator to take a quick breath before again feeding it to Tori. A third diver joined them. A knot was forming on her head from where she'd struck it against something, most likely when the ship rotated, and a fine feather of blood stained the water around the welt. He had the spare tanks and a dive helmet. Juan placed it over Tori's head and gave her sternum a sharp rap. Tori coughed into the helmet, a small amount of water pooling around her neck. Her eyes fluttered open, and she retched again. Juan used his regulator to purge the water from her helmet and kept his eyes locked on hers as she slowly came back. He knew she was going to be okay when she realized a stranger had his hand down her pants. Other divers appeared. They guided Tori and Juan out of the room. One checked Cabrillo's tanks. He'd been down the longest and working the hardest. He was okay for now, but would need fresh tanks during the decompression. Once they had swum far enough from the dangling survey ship, one of the men sent word to the Oregon that they could release the doomed vessel. A moment later, her slow, downward plunge turned into a runaway plummet, and the Avalon slipped from view. The severed ends of cable trailed behind her like steel tentacles. The team ascended in a tight group centered around Tori and Juan. The dive master shaved as much time as he dared from their stops, but it was still 10 minutes before the freshest divers could guide Tori up into the moon pool, and another 15 before Juan and the others allowed deckhands to drag them onto the metal deck plating. Juan stripped off his mask and dive hood, taking great gulps of air. The moon pool smelled of machinery oil and metal, but tasted as sweet as a clear mountain morning. Max appeared at Juan's side, handing over a mug of steaming coffee. "Sorry, old friend. No booze until all the nitrogen is dissolved out of your blood." Cabrillo was about to tell Hanley he would risk it for the worst case of Ben's in history, but he tasted the coffee and savored the sting of scotch Max had laced it with. He let Max help him out of his gear. Then he tried to get to his feet. "How is she?" he asked, his voice weak and thin from the cold. Max put a restraining hand on his shoulder. "She's with Julia. We'll know for sure soon, but I think she's going to be okay." Juan sagged back against an equipment rack with a tired and satisfied smile. At least they'd snatched one of the pirates' victims from certain death. Then he noticed several deckhands eating premium ice cream from pint containers. He knew why. Julia needed room in the big freezer for the victims they were too late to save.